History Student Association at MIT is very pleased to present Professor Noam Chomsky. Professor Noam Chomsky is Institute Professor of Linguistics at MIT, and he's known throughout the world for his groundbreaking contributions to philosophy, linguistics, and political analysis. He was the first scholar of international reputation to bring the East Timorese situation to the public attention, not only in the United States, but also in many, many other countries. Please welcome Professor Noam Chomsky.
I have to say I'm pretty much impressed by this setup here. I'm not used to that. Let me say a few words just to fill in some of the story on the American side of the what happened in the last 20 years. After that, I want to say a few things about a very current situation and indeed current priorities. And then as time permits, we'll see how long it takes, say something about what I think is really going on, what the general background is, which is quite interesting and illuminating, I think. As far as the basic story you've just heard, East Timor was a Portuguese colony when the Portuguese Empire was collapsing in the early 1970s. All the Portuguese colonies were moving towards some kind of independence. East Timor was no exception. Several political parties got organized. There was a brief civil war instigated by the Indonesians, in fact, in August 1974, in which a couple of thousand people were killed. The outcome of it was that one group described by the Australian, former Australian consul there as basically populist Catholic, Fretilin, took control after the Civil War. The Portuguese left. The Indonesians began an invasion. The invasion started right away. It was well known to Australian intelligence, to U.S. intelligence, to the British. There are lots of leaked diplomatic cables in Australia that tell the whole story. The Americans basically told the Indonesians to give them a green light, said, "We're not going to bother you. Go ahead, just do it as cleanly as you can." Kissinger's line, he was Secretary of the State at the time, was do it fast and don't use our equipment. Well, that would have been a little difficult since 90% of the equipment was from the United States, so they naturally used the equipment. The actual invasion, the official invasion, was delayed a couple of days to avoid embarrassing President Ford and Henry Kissinger, who were visiting Jakarta, so they waited until 12 hours or so after they left. The initial invasion began extremely bloodily. There was thousands of people killed within days, in fact. There was press coverage. I'll come back to that. It was pretty well known. The Security Council of the United Nations met, passed a resolution calling on Indonesia to withdraw immediately and unconditionally, and reaffirming the principles to which I'll return later, because they're very much alive, significant right now, about non-acquisition of territory by force. The United States signed on to that. However, it moved in the background to render it ineffective. The matter was described rather frankly by the U.S. Ambassador at the United Nations at the time, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, in his memoirs a couple of years later, A Dangerous Place. He describes his heroism in standing up to various third world demons at the UN, but he does happen to mention this, and what he says is that the United States wanted things to turn out as they did. My task was to render the United Nations utterly ineffective in any action it might try to undertake, and I carried this out with considerable success. He then goes on to describe the success. He says within the next few weeks, Indonesia had killed about 60,000 people in East Timor. He says approximately the proportion of the population that the Germans had killed in Eastern Europe under the Nazis. And then after having proudly compared himself to the Nazis, he moves on to the next topic, secure in the understanding that nobody here would care about that or mention it, even though it's a perfectly public book, you can read it, and that he would then become, as he is, the greatly honored exponent of international law and proper behavior among nations, constantly lauded in cover stories in the New York Times Magazine and so on for his principled commitment to international law. Well, Moynihan's a former professor. He knows how the academic world works and the media world, and his judgment turned out to be quite accurate. That's what the U.S. did at the United Nations. As for the arms, the United States did declare a boycott, a six-month boycott on arms. However, it was declared secretly, so secretly that the Indonesians, in fact, never heard about it until it came out a couple of years later when a flap was made about the thing. And meanwhile, during the boycott, the U.S. Sent new arms to Indonesia. This was pointed out by the person who really is the academic who broke the story, Ben Anderson, the leading Indonesia specialist in the United States at Cornell, testified before Congress, pointed out that, in fact, the U.S. during the period of the boycott had increased the flow of arms, including counterinsurgency equipment, OV-10 Bronco gunships and so on, used for counterinsurgency. Various leaked documents have revealed that Kissinger was mostly afraid that somebody would learn about this and would use it to undermine him. He's very paranoid, and he thought his enemies might get a hold of it. And he also said he didn't understand if there was any reason why Indonesia shouldn't proceed as they were doing, when it was pointed out to him internally, internal discussions that later leaked, that this was outright aggression. He said, well, can't we... he said very ironically, I mean, you mean to say you can't show that Timor is a communist outpost and that Indonesia is defending itself? I mean, we all know how to do that. We've been trained in it. So that would be enough, and therefore it was defense. The Indonesian attack continued. By 1978, it reached its peak. It's at that time that estimates run in international estimates, Amnesty International and others, estimate about 200,000 people killed. The original source of that is actually church sources in East Timor. But an Indonesian Jesuit who was working there did a study, which has recently been released, in which he estimated, careful study, maybe his estimate was about 350,000 people killed. The census data, these numbers, when people talk about numbers of casualties, you know, it's a big plus or minus. But it was certainly enormous, very likely the worst slaughter since relative to population since the Holocaust. It was on the scale of the Pol Pot massacres at the same time in absolute numbers, and in relative numbers, of course, far greater. 1978, it peaked. Indonesia is a big country, you know, big, powerful country, big army, but they were running out of weapons. Which indicates something about the scale of the war. The Carter administration took off a little time from moralizing about how human rights is the soul of our foreign policy in order to escalate the flow of arms to Indonesia to enable them to consummate the massacre. That's when it really reached a peak with, you know, people being driven from the hills where they had fled, pushed into concentration camps, starvation spreading all over the place, and so on. And it's been going on pretty much. That was the peak of the massacre. Since then, there have been repeated atrocities. Every once in a while, one of them breaks through. The Santa Cruz massacre, the Dili massacre that you heard about, was one that did break through to international attention. The Indonesians made a technical error there. For those of you who are interested in a career in international affairs, I offer some free advice. When you carry out a massacre, you're supposed to make sure that there's no television cameras around. Then it's okay. So there was a long series of massacres right through the 80s, which were just fine. But this one had a technical error. There was a British journalist, cameraman, hiding behind a gravestone. The first massacre was in the graveyard, and he filmed it. He filmed the Indonesian soldiers coming and, you know, shooting at the crowd and so on. And there was a second technical error made. There were two American journalists there, freelance dissidents, but nevertheless Americans. And the Indonesians were going to kill him. One was Alan Nairn, who you know, I'm sure he's a very important freelance journalist. Another was Amy Goodman, who's WBAI news director. Alan was trying to protect Amy, and he practically had his skull fractured and was practically killed and so on, and that's bad form too. You're not supposed to practically kill American reporters, even if they're dissidents. So again, some more free advice. After this, so it did get international attention. After this happens, there's a routine that you go through. If the Indonesians didn't understand them, it was explained to them by their PR firm in Washington. What you do is arrange an inquiry, in which the outcome is that you blame the victims for it, but you say we committed some errors, and some low-level soldiers may get a few months in jail, while the people who were attacked and those who survived are sent off to life sentences for crimes like insulting Indonesia and so on. And then it's the job of the foreign supporters, you know, the governments, the Australian and American government, the press and so on, to praise Indonesia for its courage in facing up to this atrocity and for having done the right thing and confess their guilt, and now we can proceed, and I'll describe how we proceed later on. That's when it did reach the public, however. And it goes on right until today. The current situation, it looks very ugly. Their repression is increasing. The bishop of East Timor, who's one of the few who can talk and sort of survive, has been giving reports. There are, by now, Indonesians who are very courageously standing up inside Indonesia, which is no joke, and condemning what's going on. That includes the leading student organizations. There's an Indonesian scholar, George Adijandro, his name is, who has just published a recent book on 20 years of research on East Timor. It came out in Holland, but it's in English, so you can read it, because you don't know Indonesian. That takes a lot of courage. It's not like talking here, you know. He's spoken out in Australia. He's a well-known environmentalist in Indonesia and also a scholar, and it's quite an interesting book. He's still surviving, but only because of international pressure, unfortunately not from here, but John Pilger is a journalist in England and journalists in Australia and others have been keeping a spotlight on him, so he's protected to some extent. And there are others, the human rights groups in Australia, legal rights group have all spoken out very strongly and bitterly condemned the West for refusing to condemn Indonesia for these actions. I'll come back to that. Inside Indonesia, there's by now considerable turmoil and protest, and it's not simple. That's a very tough totalitarian state and very brutal, but it's developing, I'll come back to what all this means. Another comment about the coverage. What do we know about all of this? Well, in the early 70s, there was very extensive coverage of East Timor, believe it or not. Take a look at the New York Times Index. You'll notice that up through about 1975, coverage is quite high. It's a little odd for a small country like that. In the United States, you don't even mention Canada, you know, let alone East Timor. It's no joke, incidentally. But East Timor did have considerable coverage. There was a reporter in Indonesia, Times reporter, and others who were covering it regularly. The reason wasn't out of any, great interest in East Timor. The reason was over the collapse of the Portuguese Empire. That was scary. The Portuguese Empire, Portugal had been a very, the fascist government in Portugal was collapsing. It had been a base for American power. Includes the military bases in the Azores and others. And its empire in Africa and in Asia, which was smaller but still there, were part of the whole system of global control. And it was collapsing, and there was concern that the colonies might actually move towards independence, what's called communism, meaning independence, kind of like Kissinger's remark about East Timor. So in that context, there was great concern. Now, we talk a lot, we're now talking about East Timor, but remember that what happened in East Timor happened in just about every Portuguese colony. In East Timor, there was a huge massacre, and exactly the same was true in Mozambique, and exactly the same was true in Angola, in Africa, and for exactly the same reasons. The idea was to try to use as much violence as was necessary to ensure that these countries would not move off on an independent path. And it worked. East Timor is small, you know, so it's maybe 200,000 people. Mozambique and Angola are bigger, and it's much worse than that. The UN commission about 2 years ago that surveyed southern Africa estimated that from 1980 to 1988 alone, come back to the reason for the choice of years, but in those years alone, South African atrocities backed by the United States and Britain primarily were responsible in the surrounding countries, primarily Mozambique and Angola, for about over $60 billion in damage and over 1.5 million people killed. Basil Davidson, who's maybe the leading Western historian of Africa, pointed out recently that the people responsible for the Contra subversion, these are Contra activities, just like Nicaragua, except on a much bigger scale, the people responsible for the Contra subversion in Angola and Mozambique will be cursed by history for terrible and enormous crimes which will weigh on southern Africa for centuries. That's the African side of what was happening in East Timor. The years 1980 to 1988 were selected because that was the period, first of all, it's the Reagan and Thatcher years, which were the worst, bad as the Carter administration was. That was the period of what was called constructive engagement. Constructive engagement meant not enforcing the World Court decision and the Security Council decision that said that South Africa had to leave Namibia, not enforcing that, but rather entering into a constructive relationship with them in which we talk to them and, you know, pat them on the back and give them arms and so on and so forth while they're carrying out these useful little exercises for us, which were not small in scale. Well, that's the context in which one should think about East Timor. It's the Asian side, small Asian side of a big global story. It's sort of misleading to look at things that happen in Africa and then in Latin America and so forth. You really have to look back where the decisions are made. If you look at the United States, which is the world dominant power, all of these, most very commonly, all of these things hang together. That's something we miss when we kind of focus on one thing or another. Part of the point of the compartmentalization of academic studies and media coverage and so on is to focus attention away from the place where it's all coming from. And that has to be very close, which in a way is good because it means we can do something about it. Well, that's in that context, there was a lot of coverage of East Timor. As the Indonesian invasion took place, everything I just described about how the U.S. knew it and how Australia knew it and so on, that has yet to appear in the American press. I mean, it's all out, you know. It's all been available since about 1976 and 77 when the diplomatic cables started leaking in Australia, and you can read about it if you look in properly arcane sources. But it still has yet to come out. Well, as the Indonesian invasion took place and the massacres started, coverage dropped. When massacres peaked in 1978 and the flow of arms peaked as well, new arms, coverage dropped to zero. There wasn't one mention in the American press. Same was true in Canada, another big supporter of Indonesia. There were no articles. Actually, I think the first article to appear on this topic was an article of mine in 1979 in an ultra-right-wing journal, the Journal Inquiry, published by the Cato Institute, which was the only journal where it was possible to publish on foreign affairs in those days. They happened to be against, state terror and stuff. This was an article based on testimony I'd given at the United Nations on the matter. There was repeated testimony. There were people active working on it. Some of them still are. And over time, they've made a big difference. There's a very small number of people. They were organizing. They were getting things to the United Nations, getting people in Congress interested, getting a few people in the media to look at it. It's finally become significant. We'll come to that. Coverage, anyway, dropped to zero by 78. Around, it started to pick up a little bit in the early 80s. In fact, the first serious article on the topic in the United States was in the Boston Globe by a local correspondent here, Bob Levy, who did a very good article in 1981 that blew the cover on a lot of things. After that, there was sporadic coverage. By now, it's the reason around 1980 was that it was becoming a little hard to overlook the fact that there were two huge massacres going on in the same place, same area, East Timor and Cambodia, and we were in total hysterics about one of them, the one that some bad guy was doing, but were being remarkably quiet about the one that we were involved in, though it was even greater and worse in character. That even the Wall Street Journal was a little concerned about that, asking editorially, how come we're claiming to oppose, well, they said are opposing Pol Pot, in fact, claiming to, while we're supporting Indonesia. That fear was soon put to rest. The State Department explained the difference. They said we have to support Pol Pot because of the, this is now the early 80s, because of the continuity, we have to support what's called Democratic Kampuchea, the Khmer Rouge-based government in Cambodia, which we were doing, attacking Cambodia from Thai bases, because of its continuity with the Pol Pot regime. So since it's continuous with the legal regime, we have to support it. On the other hand, Fretilin has no such claim, so therefore we don't support that, so it's okay to support the Indonesians. So that took care of that. We ended up supporting both Indonesia and Pol Pot, so there was no longer any contradiction. You'll be happy to know. The issue came to the attention again around 1990. The reason at that time was, again, it was pretty hard to miss something. The Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, an occupation and annexation of Kuwait, was awfully similar to the Indonesian invasion and occupation of East Timor, incidentally an oil producer. That was a large part of the reason for the invasion. It's actually an unfair comparison. It's quite unfair to Saddam Hussein, whose atrocities in Kuwait didn't even come close to what the U.S.-backed Indonesian invasion had done in East Timor. But nevertheless, it was a little embarrassing, and there was some comment about that. But that was put to rest. Again, at the time of the Dili massacre, the thing once again hit public attention for the reasons I mentioned. And there has continued to be some level of concern. By now, incidentally, just about all the major American press, at least editorially, is calling for Indonesia to do something, get out, or at least allow a referendum or something or other. Congress, finally under the pressure of a very small number of organizers, did pass legislation. It took effect in 1992 to terminate light arms sale and military training for Indonesian officers. That forced the Clinton administration into some odd gyrations. They announced, delicately selecting the anniversary of the invasion to announce it, quietly announced that they would interpret the congressional legislation as meaning the opposite of what it said. The congressional legislation said that the United States can't train Indonesian officers, and they said they would interpret it as meaning we can train Indonesian officers. It said we'll interpret it as meaning we can't pay with U.S. funds for the training. The Indonesians have to pay with presumably money we give them with some other hand. Congress protested pretty strongly, but there was no public awareness. In fact, you had to really search to find it reported. Nevertheless, it did at some level go through. And these things are important. I mean, it's not that they stopped the flow of arms and training. So Britain is delighted to move into the breach and become the leading exporter to Indonesia. If he can make a buck murdering people, you know, any self-respecting government will do that. In particular, England is entirely happy. They're now the leading military exporter to Indonesia. And Australia, as soon as the U.S. stopped sending light arms, Australia sensed a nice niche market. I was in Australia a couple of weeks ago, invited by East Timorese, in fact. And as I landed in the Sydney airport, the first headline I saw was Australia to sell 100,000 assault rifles to Indonesia. say, a little niche market opening, so they're happy to move in. But it's quite significant when the United States does anything even symbolic. There's some good reasons for that. One is that the U.S. happens to be the big mafia don, and everybody knows that. And when the top guy says, I don't like something, everybody pays notice, even pays attention, even if it's symbolic. The other thing is that there's a mutual supportive effect. When something happens here, it stimulates people in England to protest, and in Australia, and indeed conversely, the gangsters all work together, and everybody else has to as well if you want to reverse the impact of these things. So in Australia, for example, there's considerable protest against the sale of assault weapons and other contacts, and in England as well, there's some protest building up, especially due to people like John Pilger and others. And the effect of the U.S. decisions matters. It spills over. Whatever happens here has a big side effect throughout the world. Well, that's now let's come. That's sort of the background. I mean, obviously, a lot more to say. What about the current situation? One thing, as I mentioned, is repression is picking up, and that's important. Second thing is that, as somebody mentioned, the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the ambassador to Indonesia and the White House have just announced that the Clinton administration is going to reverse the intends to reverse the termination of military training, and that will presumably mean also light weapon sales. Well, that's an announcement. It hasn't been implemented yet. The effect of it will be very clear. The effect will be to tell other countries, fine, you know, go ahead, no big problem, the boss says it's all right. And for people protesting in their own countries, it's going to be a downer because, you know, what we can achieve here makes a big difference elsewhere. It has a multiplier effect. This is an announcement. It hasn't been implemented. It doesn't have to be implemented. And in fact, I think a very high priority at this point would be to make sure it doesn't get implemented. That, again, not only because of the symbolic effect, it's not that the weapons won't come from somewhere, but partly because of the symbolic effect, but partly because of the stimulative effect on others who are protesting where they are. Well, coming back to Australia, as I said, I was there at the invitation of the East Timorese refugee group. There's a big group of East Timorese refugees in Australia. It's the next country over, so that's where they fled. And there, Australia isn't the United States. We have a kind of a totalitarian culture. I mean, might as well concede it. It's a very free society, but very narrow constraints on what can get expressed. Australia is a much more open society. I spent a week giving talks mostly on this topic, but it's not like here. That means talks over, you know, at the National Press Club in Canberra, televised in all over the country, on national television, you know, repeated over and over, talks in the Sydney and Melbourne town hall with thousands of people showing up and plenty of coverage and so on. There is a background of both understanding and support. Not only are they close by, so they can see it and involved with Indonesia, but Australia has a little bit of history on this, and they know it. It's not part of official history, but it's the kind of history that people know because, you know, they're uncle told them a story about what happened, or their grandfather did this, and so on. During the Second World War, right after Pearl Harbor, Timor is the next island up, right above Australia, if you look at the map. About 10 days after Pearl Harbor, Australia invaded Timor. It was a Portuguese colony, remember. Portugal was an ally of the fascists. The fair chance that Timor would never have been invaded by the Japanese if Australia hadn't invaded. Australia and Holland both invaded. Other Portuguese colonies, Macau, were not invaded by the Japanese. In any event, Australia invaded Timor to try, as a preemptive strike. They wanted, this is their, you know, their defense perimeter. The Japanese invaded in return. There were a couple of 100 Australian commandos there, and they were able to hold out for about a year and a half. That is part of official history. They fought very, courageously. A lot of them were a lot were killed, others were picked up and sent to Japanese prison camps where they suffered miserably. That's part of history, but the part that's less known is that they were able to survive and keep fighting because they were supported by the local population. In the course of that fight, and then afterwards, after the Australians were pulled out and the Japanese went after anybody who supported them, about 60,000 Timorese were killed defending Australia. In fact, that's probably the reason Australia wasn't invaded. The Japanese were deflected long enough so they never went on to invade Australia. Well, okay, that's part of the sort of hidden history, you know, the kind of history that people sort of know because they heard it, even if they wasn't taught in school. Recently in Australia, a book came out of memoirs of soldiers who had fought in the Second World War, who just described how it happened, and that's known too. So there is a background.